joining us today. My name is Beth DeGrasse, and I work in the Center for Post-Conflict Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. I also coordinate our Afghanistan Working Group. On the eve of the London Donors Conference, our chair, Barnett Rubin, is preparing to participate as a member of the UN delegation, so he's not able to join us today. So you're stuck with me. However, mark your calendars, because on February 9th, Barney will be coming to a session of the working group, and again, he won't be chairing. Instead, he'll be briefing us on what transpired at the donors' conference. So that should be of great interest. If you're not on our list, please let us know, and we will be happy to get you the invite to that session. As Afghanistan moves to this next stage of its relationship with the international community, obviously its relationship with its neighbors assumes ever greater importance. So we are thrilled to have with us three of the top experts on Afghanistan's relationship with its neighbors here with us today. Marvin Weinbaum is going to lead us off. I will just note that he is the author of a forthcoming special report for the Institute called Afghanistan's Ever-Dangerous Neighborhood. And he will be actually giving us a preview of that report today. I will also note that yesterday an op-ed appeared with two of our speakers, our co-authors here, Dr. Fred Starr and Marvin Weinberg, along with Ambassador Rick Linderfer. It has just been made available out on the table, so I commend this to you. As I said, Marvin will lead us off. He will give us actually a snapshot of this report, and then we will be followed by Dr. Fred Starr and Ambassador Grant Smith. I'm not going to introduce each one of them or go into detail on their bios. Suffice to say, they're probably known to most of us, and their expertise is also well known, but their bios are available outside. So due to the interest of time, I'm going to pass it right to Marvin.
Thank you, Marvin. Beth. You know, we all say Afghanistan lives in a difficult, very likely dangerous neighborhood, because we're, I think, aware that it's a fact of life that Afghanistan has been living with predatory neighbors for some time, and certainly its history bears that out. And no question about much of the instability and misery of the people of the country can be traced to those countries' strategic, ideological, economic interests in Afghanistan. Afghanistan has responded to that by resisting at times, by isolating itself at times, in various ways. Sometimes, though, we should mention that those external actors have been intervening on behalf of domestic clients. So that the Afghans certainly cannot be excused for not partaking sometimes in their own tragedies. Certainly not. For the fratricide, for the destruction that's occurred in recent decades, the Afghans bear responsibility as well. But there's no doubt that the outside states have had an aggravating role and have made whatever civil conflict has occurred in the country far more sustained and lethal. This study that Beth is talking about does posit, though, that Afghanistan's neighbors have, for the last 4 years, by and large, supported a stable, independent, economically strengthening Afghanistan state as preferable at the moment to the realistic alternatives for them. None have directly opposed the internationally approved Hamid Karzai as president or seriously tried to manipulate Afghan politics. Some have pledged, and when I say neighbors here, I'm including Russia and India as well. Some have given economic assistance, development assistance, and undoubtedly some of this forbearance on their part is traceable to the fact that there are foreign military forces in the country and that there is international attention on Afghanistan. But these strategic approaches are subject, naturally, to readjustment, because none of these regional states is going to allow any other state a predominance, preponderance of influence in Afghanistan. They maintain their links to client networks for the most part, and are capable of fractionalizing and destabilizing Kabul government in the event that it fails over time to extend its authority and to tangibly improve the lives of Afghans. And certainly, should the international community lose its patience with Afghanistan. What I try to show in this paper is that, in the study, is that there are some currents out there which are a little bit worrisome. Several of these countries, what we're seeing is that the economic imperatives, which in most cases are what have driven the optimistic projections for regional cooperation, that some of these are being pushed hard by some political forces, and that some of these countries, it seems to me that this forbearance is flagging, and that we can therefore perhaps anticipate increased suspicions and tensions. I want to recognize here that some of what we're talking about is not just simply outside intervention, but the fact that Afghanistan has been the theater for conflicts going on in the region, as between, naturally, India and Pakistan. And I don't have to, in this group, go into the way in which Afghanistan has been seen as a potential partner in a what we refer to as strategic distance for Pakistan. But there's been a desire over time, naturally, that there be a cooperative state, if not a satellite state, on the part of Pakistan. And also, I would mention the regional competition between Pakistan and Iran has also involved Afghanistan. Now, framing all of these discussions, and I won't go into the details here, but framing all of these discussions is the idea that Afghanistan and the region are closely bound together. That essential to regional stability are constructive partnerships between Afghanistan and its neighbors. And that the capacity of Afghanistan to overcome its political and economic deficits will have a deep bearing on the region's security and development. And at the same time, the domestic stability and foreign policies of those countries will affect progress in Afghanistan, the prospects for progress in Afghanistan. I want to suggest also that in this context that many of what we view as the challenges for Afghanistan really have international dimensions to them, that you can't deal with problems such as drugs and arms without seeing these in regional context. Certainly, when we're talking about naturally trade as well as smuggling, but especially the drug trade now, there are no ways to approach this without an international approach. Now, having said this, I want to just mention, though, that I think that we have to be realistic about what the region bears for Afghanistan. It would be, I think, wrong to overstate the compatibility and the common interests that exist among the regional states. We hear talk that Afghanistan might become again the Silk Road, its position here is a potential crossroads. I think we have to recognize that there are real liabilities in this day and age in all land transit, and that there are alternatives to this. We have to recognize that for the most part, this region trades outside the region, not within the region. And that although a great deal can be done to harmonize customs policies and border security arrangements, there are infrastructural problems, not to mention security problems, which give one cause for concern. So that Fred, for example, has posited an ideal here of a greater Central Asia, and has suggested that even if it has to be done on an a la carte basis, this has some promise. The recent World Bank study, though I commend to your attention, does question whether we see here some natural trade partnerships. Certainly Afghanistan with Iran and Pakistan, those are flourishing trade arrangements, and those could expand much further. But the idea of Afghanistan as the hub for a regional trade zone, given its deficiencies, its physical deficiencies, and obviously its current problems with infrastructural deficiencies and its current problems, security problems, as I suggested, leave one some doubts. There is a greater possibility, according to the World Bank, for energy and water sharing, those resources. But what we're likely to see is bilateral agreements rather than multilateral agreements. I might suggest, though, that Afghanistan's recent admission to SAARC is interesting because, in a way, it gives Afghanistan potentially an alternative to Central Asia, both in real terms and in psychological terms, which may be important. Now, I just want to spend what remaining time I have looking particularly at two countries, at Pakistan and Iran. And I know that Grant and Fred, in addition to other things, will give more attention here to Central Asia and Russia. Naturally, there's a great deal that links Pakistan and Afghanistan. And we recognize right off that the provincial and inter-ethnic rivalries in both those countries have fueled insurgencies across their borders. That the Pashtun population both brings these two countries together and has set them apart. And that notion of strategic depth that we mentioned before really involves the Pashtun population and ideas about having this population as a cooperative partner with Pakistan. But the way in which Pakistan has handled this over time has been to try to have it both ways, both to avoid the potential dangers of Pashtun nationalism and at the same time take advantage of its natural links inside Afghanistan. And the way, as you many of you know, it has done this has been by espousing those Pashtuns who were pushing the most conservative trans-Islamic beliefs and religious agendas. There are many who believe that Pakistan has been, in the course of doing this, exploiting, through its cross-border clientelism, exploiting the ethnic mosaic, which is Afghanistan. Certainly there's evidence of this in the support of the Mujahideen, in the support of the Taliban. It's paid a tremendous price for doing so, because while it supported the Taliban, as you know, it poisoned its relationship with Iran, with the Central Asian republics, and with Russia. And it's paid a price also in terms of the blowback that has occurred within Pakistan because of that support. Now, what I argue is that what we see with Pakistan is a two-track policy. that it is the fact, I think, that Pakistan can at the moment profit from a stable and an economy in Afghanistan which is improving. And not all of Afghanistan, you know, many in Afghanistan blame all their problems on Pakistan. I think that there's a tendency to do this, rather than, for example, to recognize the extent to which the security problems are internal to Afghanistan. But this two-track policy is that at one level, the Islamabad government does hope work for stability and economic recovery. Yes, it would like a more pliable regime in Kabul, but it has no choice but to respect the political process. I think there's evidence of this that we can see in the election process from the Bonn Agreement on, that there were a number of times in which Pakistan could have played a spoiler role and hesitated to do so in terms of its influence within the Pashtun community. A great deal of this has to do with the business interests. Private investment, as well as a relatively stable Afghanistan, does obviously further Pakistan's business interests. It has, to some extent, although not certainly at the pace that one would have wanted it to see, contributed to reconstruction and rehabilitation. Now, undoubtedly, a large part of this is simply because of Pakistan's partnership with the United States, in which it can ill afford to play an unhelpful role as long as it also seeks to maintain its partnership with the United States because of the adverse effect, obviously, on the anti-insurgency, anti-terrorism campaigns that both are supposedly partners in. But at the same time that it has this, it has a second track. And that second track undercuts the first, because while trying to pursue at the official level a cooperative and helpful face towards Afghanistan, its managing of its own extremist groups, as I say, undercuts that. We know that it has indulged and created some of these Islamic forces, and that it offers them official protection. We know that there are training camps. We know that there is a capacity here to for the neo-Taliban to operate with a certain degree of impunity within the country, and that the real attention that Pakistan has been playing has been to the so-called foreigners, to the people who are often labeled as al-Qaeda. So as long as you have this two-tier, I think that clearly Pakistan is trying to both keep the international community from coming down too hard on it, particularly the United States, but at the same time, it also has no choice but to, because of its own political, domestic political considerations, to especially with respect to the border areas and the extent to which those border areas maintain a great deal of sympathy for the neo-Taliban. I think what we're seeing more and more is the fact that with all of that's happening along the border areas, that it is the al-Qaeda that rules the border areas, and particularly Waziristan, and not the Pakistan Army. Very quickly now, and I want to conclude, is Iran. Iran has Iran's ambitions, political, strategic ambitions, are not focused on Afghanistan. That future lies with the Persian Gulf and, of course, involvement with Iraq. But so what is it then? And it, to my mind, it's the opportunity for economic expansion and cultural rather than rivalry politically and militarily. But at the same time, it is strategically concerned that other powers may take advantage of Afghanistan, and particularly with a focus on Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, and particularly since 2001, the United States. But Iran's interests for the time being are served by regional stability and stability within Afghanistan. It has not sought to export its revolutionary zeal there. It has never allowed itself to become a base of operations for operations against the Afghan government. Iran is fearful of a new wave of refugees, and I think that above all we want to focus on the fact that Iran is doing exceedingly well now economically within Afghanistan. It has, in effect, replaced Pakistan. There are, I think, something like 400 to 500 trucks which just cross that border at the crossing which comes over from Herat every single day. It has offered to provide electricity. It is talking about extending its rail system. But to conclude on this, this could change, and the United States will be a catalyst in this change. Obviously, Tehran feels very uneasy about the recent memorandum of understanding, and it has wanted a reasonably strong government in order to withstand the United States and other powers, but it is now clearly nervous about what is happening on the border. It sees, obviously, special forces out in that direction. And so that, together with some of the things that Karzai has been saying about Israel, also, I think, run counter to what we're goes down well in Tehran. And now with this new government, Ahmadinejad, I believe, has undercut some of this good relationship by removing the very people in the foreign ministry who I think were instrumental in maintaining this rather productive relationship with Afghanistan. Afghanistan, therefore, I think we ought to be concerned about the impact of more ideological aggressive foreign policy on the part of Iran, maybe more mischievousness, largely as a result of this arrangement for possible military basing, and also should the United States move ahead with the Europeans on UN-approved sanctions. Now, if this doesn't come apart, and I still think that Iran is relatively satisfied with the situation in Afghanistan, if this doesn't, it will be the economic forces, it will be the businessmen in Iran which keep this relationship normalized and prevent, I think, the kind of aggressiveness that I think we have reason to worry about. So let me conclude, because really there's part of my problem here is just to try to go through the study, and it's difficult to try to pick out pieces here and there. But in the end here, the stability of this region, particularly the success of Afghanistan to avoid the predatory nature of the neighborhood that it lives in, is, for the time being, does rest on the international community. I don't think there's any question about this, that as long as the international community remains committed, that these naturally predatory neighbors, I think, are going to be kept at bay. And I think this is essentially where we understand Afghanistan is at the moment. And I personally believe, although there's a great deal of concern now, which I found in my recent travels in Afghanistan, there's a great deal of concern now that the United States is about to begin an exit. I think that's arguable, because I don't think that we can seriously think about reducing our commitment. However, sometimes the way in which we construct our policy does send the wrong signals. Obviously, we want to create far more of this, to make this an international enterprise. It has been from the very beginning an international enterprise. We want to, obviously, to increase this. But at the same time, I don't believe that the United States, if it does not want to see this area become, again, a spawning ground for international terrorism, if it wants to keep Pakistan stable, if it wants to see a recovering Afghanistan, the United States and the international community must remain committed. Okay.
Thank you, Marvin. Dr. Starr.
Well, I would like to first note that what I'm about to say is had a wonderful introduction from my friend Marvin Weinbaum, because the second half of his paper more or less provided the backup evidence that I'm not going to have time to give, even while the first raised some questions. Let me say that I think the difference between what I'm about to offer and what you have just heard is the difference between tactics and strategy. I think all the concerns that Marvin Weinbaum raises are legitimate, they're real, they need to be attended to, but in the end of the day, these are tactical questions. And what I want to offer is a strategic perspective. A strategic perspective inevitably has a certain, optimistic cast to it, because it must consider possibilities that aren't instantly evident in the moment. But it's exactly having a strategic perspective that enables you to choose and to form tactical moves that will have the maximal positive effect on the situation. So I understand I'm not going to deal with the tactics. I'd be glad afterwards to discuss them in detail. I want to lay out a strategic perspective. Now, first of all, with regard to the region, the region is indeed Afghanistan and all the neighbors that Marvin Weinbaum listed, including China, including, I would submit, Middle East, including Europe, including Southeast Asia. All these are regions which traditionally, and by that I mean 2,500 years, carried out continental trade through Central Asia. Now, the difference on trade between the points that were just made before and the points I am offering is that I'm speaking about continental trade. I'm not so much emphasizing intra-regional trade. Continental trade is 18-wheeler trade. Continental trade is super jets fueling at airports in the region. It is the Korean transport planes that use Tashkent Airport as a base, as a fueling stop en route to Middle East and to Europe, etc. It is really long range, and while it is true that in some respects trade by shipping is cheaper, it doesn't get you where you want to get in most of the instances that are relevant here. I invite you to consult a map. Now, what the thesis is very simple. Afghanistan basically dropped out of the world trading zone for a generation and a half, but before that, it had been cut out from the period of basically in the 30s when the Soviets decisively closed the border, down to the end of Soviet rule. It had been cut out of a lot of the North-South trade as well. Now, not all of it, but the two things have happened that fundamentally changed the situation. One, the collapse of the USSR, which has had long-delayed effects, the decision of the State Department to move the former Soviet states of Central Asia into the South Asia division, in other words, to reunite them with Afghanistan, is a direct long-term effect of that. It has also had the effect of basically removing the biggest trade barrier, the longest biggest trade barrier in the world, which was the southern and eastern border of the USSR. Now, look on a map. Suppose you are a cotton producer in Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, wherever. You are marketing most of your cotton today through the Baltic, just like you're marketing your gas and oil through the Baltic. It's an absurd situation. It gives you 65 cubic dollars a cubic meter for gas from Turkmenistan when the world price is many, many times that. To Gazprom, it gives you, the Uzbeks last week couldn't even get $65. They settled for $60. And the same is happening in cotton. The same is happening, cotton could much more simply be marketed through Karachi, through the southern ports to India, the Bombay area, Gujarat, and so on. It's not happening. And as for everything else, not to mention trade in the other direction. Trade down from a booming Xinjiang into the Middle East. It has to cross Central Asia and Afghanistan. Trade from Southeast Asia to the Middle East or to Europe, land trade, or to Russia, or from Pakistan or India up to Siberia and the Urals, which are hurting right now economically, but would cease to be once they had a real trade channel to the south. Now, the virtue of continental trade is that continental trade is an organized trade that is subject to normal tariffs and taxation. It is a lucrative trade for the countries through which it passes. It is an engine for development for Afghanistan and all the other states. It is not true that the World Bank study denies this. The World Bank study ignores it. It only considers intra-regional state trade, and so does the recent UN study, which only considers intra-regional trade. There has been practically no research except the Asia Development Bank on continental trade. Fortunately, this is changing. The Japanese are looking at it. Indians are looking at it. As you just heard, the Iranians with 500 trucks a day, that says something about continental trade. It's not all going to Pakistan, to Afghanistan. Some is going on to Pakistan. It should be going on beyond that. Nor is it true that Iran's economic perspectives are concentrated on the Persian Gulf. Iran has always been predominantly an eastward-looking country, back to Mughal times and much before. So this is the bigger issue that I'm proposing here. And I'd like to suggest that this is fundamentally coming on the agenda. You will have out here some copies of a paper I wrote 6 months ago on a greater central concept of a greater Central Asia, and embracing Xinjiang, Iran, Pakistan, and so forth. And there's also a piece that I did on the same theme, shorter version, in Foreign Affairs last summer, and now a number of further, much more specific and technical pieces that are appearing. I want to submit that the U.S. has, at the moment, no strategy for this region. None. It has a post-9/11 strategy, which has been, by and large, successful. But there is not yet a post-9/11 strategy. That's what I'm trying to suggest might lie in continental trade. The U.S., however, it is revealing that the State Department shift enables it to deal with such projects as the Tajik-Afghan bridge over the Panj River, a major stimulus to north-south intercourse. The U.S. is involved with road building in Afghanistan, also with various transport projects all over the region that are relevant. Beyond that, it's worth noting that the proposed New Silk Road Act that is under discussion at the moment includes, in all drafts, a significant element of continental trade. And putting U.S. behind it, not as the organizer of it, but as a kind of mediator, as a kind of partner for those who want to engage in it, and it can be accomplished, fostered both through bilateral and multilateral means. Beyond that, there is a conference that we're holding in Kabul at the very beginning of April. It's interesting that we have foreign ministers from the region inviting themselves to the conference. Simply because they consider this is a topic, it's not against anyone. Continental trade is not against anyone. Everyone benefits from it. They're beginning to sense this, notwithstanding the mutual suspicions and worse than that, the mutual ignorance of one another that prevails among many of the governments. Beyond that, the Asia Development Bank has consistently emphasized this as its main strategic objective and across the entire region, and has masses of studies and projects that are directed in this line. The OSCE in the last 3 months has made a decision to move to take this up as its chief function in the region. The OSCE held a conference that began this issue in Dushanbe a couple of months ago. It's going to have a follow-up meeting in Istanbul, and it's going to undertake quite a lot of work in this line. The EU, I just returned from briefing the incoming EU presidency from next round in Helsinki 3 days ago. The subject of conversation was continental trade. Obviously, they have an interest in one specific element of it now, continental trade in hydrocarbons, gas and oil, and obviously they are interested now in reviving their Traseca program and adding to it gas and oil before they get completely aced on this by Gazprom, which just two, three days ago signed a potential deal with the Uzbeks to develop the West Uzbek fields precisely to keep them from participating in continental trade to the West. Continental trade also involves, of course, gas and oil, involves electricity, rather, and this is a big export potential for the countries of Central Asia down to Pakistan. There are a lot of dimensions to this, but Japan, meanwhile, with its new 6+1 program, is desperately trying to overcome internal bureaucratic problems and feed Afghanistan into that program and to add a serious element of continental trade. The private sector is also very relevant to this. There are major firms that are betting the farm on this. I think of the great Turkish construction firm Yüksel, which is working in Afghanistan, working all over the region. It sees itself as a giant in the construction of international trade routes. It just completed the section of the China Tajikistan road over the Kulma Pass, another Turkish firm did. But the private sector is actively working in all this. In other words. Now, what I mean to suggest by all this is that this is a strategically valuable development. It is not going to happen without some help, but it is happening because of the inherent logic of the situation. What does it mean for Afghanistan? It means an income stream. And without an income stream, you cannot have a sustainable government. Why did 9/11 occur? Because, not because there were too few NGOs in Afghanistan. Was Al-Qaeda an NGO? That's an interesting, I've never asked myself that question. But it's not because it was inhospitable to initiative outside the state. The problem was there was no state. And the, I think, tragedy of the Bonn Agreement and all those who have made careers from the Bonn Agreement is that this focused totally on politics. It did not deal anything with the development of the state. There is not one deadline in the Bonn Agreement about development of state institutions. Yet that is the absence of state institutions is exactly what made not only 9/11 possible, but what makes impossible normal continental trade. Now, this has to change, and an emphasis on continental trade will naturally lead to an emphasis on the development of normal state institutions. That means border institutions, customs institutions, tariff institutions, information institutions, connection of local governments with the center. The Germans paid for the establishment of telecommunications between 35 or whatever it is provinces and Kabul, but there, not one district capital is linked electronically with Kabul. How can you talk about continental trade? How can you talk about dealing with drugs? How can you talk about anything when you don't even have that? All the emphasis has been on politics, very little on normal development of state institutions. There's been the development of training programs, very commendable. Germans did that, but it's still in 8 provinces now. They have training centers for local civil servants, but this is just at the most rudimentary stage, and it has to go a lot further. Now, where does all this lead? It seems to me that it's time to think post 9/11. Whether it's this strategy or another, you do not replace one strategy just with a collection of tactics. You have to have some kind of organizing conception. What I'm proposing is of continental trade is not against anyone. Interestingly, the Chinese have been actively involved in this. That's why they built the deep water port at Gwadar, which is really opening this spring. That is a strategic move on their part on continental trade, totally meshing with U.S., Japanese, Saudi activity to develop the Ring Road in Afghanistan. The Indians are keenly interested in continental trade and trying to figure out how you can do it and what how without dealing Pakistan into it. In the long run, you can't. If you want to get a truck from Gujarat into Xinjiang, you have to go through up the Karakoram Highway, which is also, by the way, being rebuilt. That means coming to some kind of a deal with Pakistan. This is a very healthy. What this does, continental trade emphasizes people's common interests and upstages their points of conflict. Now, that's strategy when you have something like that going. The Iranians are keenly interested. Why are they building the port at Chabahar, just a little west of the Chinese port at Gwadar? And by the way, there's a Russo-Chinese tension here. The Russians supporting the Iranian port at Chabahar, the Chinese building the port at Gwadar. It is China, Pakistan, Russia, Iran, India trying to avoid the Gwadar part. We'll see how that works out because it's a much deeper port, it's closer, and so forth. But all of this is benefits Afghanistan because it wants to take all of these routes want to take advantage of transit across Afghanistan. That is Afghanistan's future income stream. As to Iran, I accept absolutely. I underscore the points that Marvin Weinbaum made. Iran is sending 500 trucks a day. That's serious, as is Pakistan, by the way. Iran has a tremendous vocation in trade going through to Southeast Asia, not just India, but beyond. This is a different Iran, as Marvin said. These are the kind of hardhead business people. This is not the Iran of the current president. It seems to me this you don't want to bring them in. You don't want to welcome them in on this yet. But it certainly provides a stimulus to everyone to move beyond this terrible impasse we're at there now. So let me end with this and simply say I, at the risk of overstating and repeating the obvious, you don't replace a strategy with tactics. You replace a strategy with strategy. All the countries in the region are asking, is the U.S., does it have a strategy here? And all this peculiar behavior you've been seeing in the last months, last half year, is occasioned by countries assuming that they have to make some plan B on the assumption that the U.S. will be fickle as it's been before and not have a sustaining interest in the region. I believe if there is a new Silk Road Act, I believe if the Department of State would lift its eyes beyond immediate and endless short-term issues and think in strategic terms also, that there is a prospect for not an expensive, but a consistent U.S. policy that is region-wide, that is not against any other interested party in the region, which benefits everyone, and particularly that benefits Afghanistan in the long run and makes it a sustainable economy and state. Thank you.
I will note that Marvin's paper does endorse this your view, the strategic view, the continental view, and but perhaps if the World Bank and the UN have not dealt with the subject adequately, it suggests that there's another paper maybe that we should be considering. I'm going to give the last word to Ambassador Smith, and then we will open it up for everyone else to join in.
Well, Marvin and Fred are hard acts to follow. I'll try and be somewhere in between the two, looking at the situation a little bit more from the angle of the Central Asians, because my thesis is that the Central Asians do perceive a real threat from Afghanistan. It isn't just that they're intervening to achieve geostrategic objectives, but they they have experienced and perceive a threat from Afghanistan. On the other hand, there are real opportunities, we've just heard from Fred. The question is, how do you to move forward to create organizations, programs that deal with the threats, that take advantage of the opportunities? First, on the threats, Islamic extremism following the fall of the Soviet Union is perceived as a threat by the Central Asians from Afghanistan. You had the Tajikistan Civil War with the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan, then part of the United Tajik Opposition, operating in part out of Afghanistan. That has been solved by a peace agreement in Tajikistan, but one which other Central Asians are very suspicious of still. And of course, after that, you had the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan operating from Afghanistan, supported by al-Qaeda, supported by the Taliban, operating from northern Afghanistan across Tajikistan into Kyrgyzstan and targeted at Uzbekistan. And there are still Uzbeks down in the border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan, although the leadership, the military leadership, the organization was taken out. There are still fighters there, and there are presumably still remnants of the organization left in Uzbekistan itself. Let me talk a bit about narcotics, and this is something that Fred and Marvin didn't talk about. According to the UN, 19% last year, I should say 2004, it's not last year anymore, 19% of the Afghan opium and heroin was exported by Central Asia, a slight drop from the previous year. Interestingly, if you look back into the methodology of the UN, you find that they're relying largely on seizure statistics in Tajikistan, and they're taking no account of any movement of narcotics across, particularly Turkmenistan, while you assume that there is a fair amount going across there, just that they aren't having any seizures of narcotics. So presumably the actual figure is higher than this. This is tied to an increase in growing of opium in northern Afghanistan. Clearly, the preferable route, export route, is going to be the closest border. So you've got a real existing problem and pressure for further exports into Central Asia from Afghanistan. And there's real money involved. An order of magnitude figure would be that the profit for moving a kilo of opium from one border of Tajikistan to the other border of Tajikistan is $500. And if you're talking about heroin, that's 7 or 10 times as much, probably. $500, and let's see, 20% of the Afghan opium, you're talking around maybe 800 tons. Going through Tajikistan, and you multiply that by $500 a kilo, and you get up to $400 million just for taking it across Tajikistan. This is real money. This is as much as, same order of magnitude as international assistance, same order of magnitude as the remittances to Tajikistan from the workers in Russia and Kazakhstan. And it's probably only part of it because The pattern is that the Afghans take it to the border, and then from the border it's moved by Tajiks who are linked to trading criminal organizations in Russia, of which they may be a part. And if you look at the profit for moving it to Moscow, you're getting up into the billions of dollars, and the Central Asians have a share in that. And again, we aren't looking particularly at Turkmenistan. There's a big chunk there. So that you've got a real problem of very well-financed criminal groups in Central Asia tied to Russian criminal groups. You also have a problem with increasing addiction and HIV. I went back last night and looked at the UN's statistics estimates for Tajikistan, 50,000 addicts and 5,000 cases of HIV is the estimate, and that certainly has been growing dramatically since I was there. And I would say parenthetically that if you look at the other neighbors of Afghanistan, narcotics is really a threat to them also, because the UN for 2004 estimated that 60% of the Afghan opium heroin production went out through Iran, increased from the previous year. So a real problem for Iran, 20% through Pakistan. If you look at Iran, you find, a UN figure, that 20% of Iranians between the ages of 15 and 70 are involved somehow in drug abuse, with 6% hardcore addicts. So narcotics are a real threat from Afghanistan to its neighbors, and of course an area of potential cooperation. Fred has talked about the opportunities for cooperation on energy, electricity and gas, and on transport. I must admit that I was skeptical about the electricity possibilities until I looked at figures, and the most striking one is that electricity could probably be delivered to Pakistan for 2 to 3 cents a kilowatt hour, less than the existing marginal generation cost there, electricity from Central Asia. They both in the case of gas and electricity, the Central Asians have an incentive to open up the routes to the south to be so that they aren't totally reliant on Russia. Fred mentioned Gazprom, but there's also RAU-ES, which is trying to do the same thing on the electricity side. And I would add also that it isn't just the Heidel people, because the hydroelectric production in Central Asia is very seasonal. In fact, Tajikistan right now is a net importer in the winter. And if you had electricity produced by gas in Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan being shipped to Afghanistan, you would have something of a balance there. So you do have a common interest between Central Asia and Afghanistan in controlling terrorism, controlling narcotics, developing energy for transmission across Afghanistan, and developing transport links. How do you get there? There is no single regional organization that covers all of the countries and all of the issues. If anything, there are too many regional organizations, each of which has a particular group of countries or a particular issue, but there is no single regional organization, and many of the existing ones are ineffective. It's probably going to be best done by limited groupings, perhaps bilateral deals, but very focused limited groupings and bilateral agreements. Now, Marvin mentioned the World Bank study. This is the World Bank study he was talking about, which I find very good. It is somewhere between Fred and Marvin in the sense that it says you've got to have the vision, but in practical terms, you need to focus on specific short-term things that you can do. And it zeroes in three areas, electricity and transport and trade facilitation. On electricity, its argument is that the first thing that needs to be done is to build transmission lines from Central Asia into northern Afghanistan and start building a grid within Afghanistan. You get, because there's a demand in Afghanistan, you get that established, and later you can expand to Pakistan. On road links, it emphasizes looking for bottlenecks. It highlights the importance of that bridge that is already being built from Tajikistan to Afghanistan. And parenthetically, I would say that that's important because it opens up part of Central Asia that has hitherto been restricted by Uzbekistan controls. Tajikistan, with that bridge and with a road network in Afghanistan, will be able to trade without going to Uzbekistan. And with the construction of further roads in Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan will be able to do the same thing, which would be very important. The World Bank study focuses on trade facilitation measures, problems in moving things across borders. It actually recommends that if there are trading regimes that are too restrictive, you may just want to bypass some of those countries. And I think that may be spelled Uzbekistan right now in the short term. It does recognize that when you make movement of goods easier, you also make trafficking easier. And you have to do something about that. You have to have as they propose, a risk-based regime, counter-narcotics regime, basically. U.S. interests, we clearly have an interest in controlling terrorism and narcotics, seeing these countries succeed, and in the World Bank proposals. However, there are areas of the World Bank proposals that may cause conflicting interests for us. We want to see Afghanistan succeed. For Afghanistan to succeed, it benefits by competition between these routes to Iran and Pakistan. It really benefits. But of course, that gets into our Iran policy. Now, there is a way around it, and that's to work with Pakistan to make the Pakistan route more attractive. And I think that involves both infrastructure and the Pakistani regime, because I see some nodding of heads here. Pakistan has traditionally had a very restrictive regime on trade with Afghanistan. Its concept has been historically, well, we'll let Afghanistan have what we decide Afghanistan needs. So there are things that need to be done there. On the other side of it, however, if our Iranian policy, if we're really concerned about Iran, we ought to be concerned also about the proposal for the pipeline from Iran through Pakistan to India. And an alternative to that is the pipeline from Turkmenistan to Afghanistan to Pakistan, which ADB says can stand on its own without going on to India. And we should support that then. So there are some very specific things that we can do, not only having the strategic view, but also in the short term, based on the World Bank recommendations, but also our specific interests in the area, including Iran.
Thank you. I'm going to open up the floor. Stuart Patrick?
Stuart Patrick from the Center for Global Development. Fred, you, I really enjoyed your presentation, but you said your comment that there was no U.S. strategy for the region. I think it's a little clearer than the truth. I think that until I left the State Department policy planning staff a little less than a year ago, one of the last things that I was working on with a number of colleagues was precisely pursuant to interagency decisions, precisely looking at this question of how does one try to integrate Afghanistan into the wider region. And actually, when I read your foreign affairs piece, I was almost in a state of shock, and in the directions that it was sort of suggesting were really ones that I think were aired very volubly in discussions within state and within the wider interagency. And the rationales were very similar to the ones that you laid out. The motivations for the regional framework, the strategic logic that Afghanistan eventually would have to seek its future in the region, the region itself was woefully under-institutionalized, and that the best place to start was on pragmatic, even technocratic issues on which most of the parties in the region could agree, notwithstanding many of Marvin's excellent observations about the difficulties and the frictions within the region and the fact that many of these countries didn't want to have that much to do with each other, and that the participation could be subject to variable geometry depending on whether the issue was trade, energy, water, narcotics, et cetera. So I think, I haven't been at state since early February of last year. I know we have a few interagency colleagues here. I know Nitin Madhav, who's here from USAID, might be able to comment more on some of these issues. But my understanding, having gone to a conference in Istanbul in June and talking to some members of the Afghan government there, Foreign Minister Abdullah and others, was that, in fact, partly the United States had passed off some of the responsibility for pursuing this regional development framework or initiative to the UK government, which had been helping the Afghans to actually move forward with some of these ideas, with some technical support, perhaps from the World Bank, et cetera. So I'd be interested in those who are more in the loop than I about knowing the degree to which the U.S. government is actually moving forward in this. But I think it would be wrong to suggest that that there has not been any strategic thinking in this regard.
I didn't say that there had been no thinking, and I am aware of all the points you made. The fact is, though, notwithstanding that thinking, there's no policy. It hasn't ripened. I'm not suggesting it won't, but it hasn't. And it's partly the differences between strategy with a big S and a small S. When I read Dan Fried's statement on U.S. strategy in the region, it's very small S. It's a lot of little tactics. It doesn't add up to capital S strategy. They sent the Secretary of State running around the region, and every country that she visited was struck by the absence of any strategic perspective. This was the opportunity to do it. It didn't happen. I myself hope that it will, that the discussions that you refer to that continue will produce something, but my expectation at this point is that the initiative is more likely to come from Congress. As to the UK, let me assure you they're not doing this. And the World Bank is not the key international player in this issue. It's the ADB, and they've been out ahead of everyone for many years on it.
Can I just add that it's going to be difficult to have a strategic perspective when you have conflicting goals? And I think that that's a hurdle that has to be mounted first.
Thank you, first of all, for bringing the focus on Afghanistan, at least for a while. This question is directly perhaps to Dr. Starr, and I'll be interested in the rest of the panel. I happen to actually find myself to agreeing with Dr. Starr that there is, in practice, no U.S. foreign policy for the region. We have to look at what is on the ground and what's in practice, rather than what may be the thinking. I agree that trade today defines so much of the issues around the region, and it's a very important thing that perhaps is going to drag other issues forward, especially even though trade has always been needed. What has happened today now is the role of the explosive growth in China and in India, and it's the creation of this counterweight as a giant economic power to both the U.S. and Europe. And by the way, I also agree that the other weights are really, you know, I only see China and India and the U.S. As much as Europe is there, they're not unified in their strategies, and their, you know, inherent weakness is in that. You don't clearly see that. What I'd like to ask the panel is a focus now on perhaps besides trade, because trade never defines really, you know, in a way national policy and regional security. For example, India will never open up trade routes through Pakistan, even though their needs are a lot greater now than they used to be. So it would be interesting perhaps to look at what is going to happen with China and India in the future and their specific national security needs, and perhaps because of those needs, what will happen in the region, and the counterbalance, and more specifically, if U.S. doesn't have a presence or a strategy that's very clear. In fact, I would argue that the U.S. needs to have a foreign policy strategy with China in regards to Central Asia. If you can perhaps expand for a minute about the domestic politics of China and India, that would be interesting to talk about. Dr. Starr or Dr. Weinberg?
Go ahead.
Mr. Smith.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, I just would say just one thing about as far as India is concerned. I think we have to remember that it's Pakistan that prevents India from shipping directly. Pakistan has not permitted, it permits Afghan goods to go to India, but not Indian goods to go to Pakistan. So what we're really talking about here is there has to be progress simultaneously at the political level. Much of what we're talking here about, the economic rationality, it's there. It's there. Certainly, if it doesn't live up to the great expectations, at least there's no question here that it would contribute. But at the same time that this is going on, what we're seeing is some political developments. We've mentioned Uzbekistan. Russia today is not playing a helpful role in Afghanistan. Russia is being mischievous there, particularly in some of the northern provinces. I've mentioned Iran here as being, to some extent, ready to counter the United States if that's necessary. But that's the point I would stress here, that we can't, for all of the economic mandate that seems to exist here to go forward, we've got to see simultaneously political progress. And if anything, my study suggests that we're seeing some counter moves here, and this is worth it.
I'll just add a note. Both China and India, their interests in this continental trade absolutely dovetail with ours. To the extent that they, however, engage Iran, for the time being, on that they don't. But that is not a deal breaker for collaborating. The Chinese initiatives on Gwadar exactly complement American initiatives in Afghanistan. They'd be impossible without them. The Indian initiatives to building connections through Afghanistan, road connection to the port in Iranian port at Chabahar, it benefits Afghanistan. It complements U.S. interests. I mean, so it seemed I'd be rather more optimistic about this. The Indians are only now, however, beginning to calculate the potential economic gain from this. No country in the region has systematically done this. The Indians are beginning to do so. As a result, as early as 5-6 years ago, the heads of several of the big Indian firms traveled all over Central Asia. I was with them. I asked, when are you going to be up there? And they said, well, as soon as we can get an 18-wheeler up. This is Godrej. These are big manufacturers. The spread of Indian restaurants, I take throughout the region, I take as a harbinger of something happening, as was the big Indian trade fair in Kabul a year or so ago. So I'd be rather sanguine. Now, as to the Russian role, I'd want to allude here to the TAP type pipeline project that Grant Smith mentioned. Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan project, which of course has the full potential to go on to India. This has been another one of these geopolitical games from which Afghanistan suffers. The game has nothing to do with Afghanistan, however. In this case, the game is Russia trying to prevent Turkmenistan from exporting its most valuable resource by any channel other than through Gazprom. And hence, they pushed very hard to get this Iran-Pakistan-India pipeline advance at a big step 2 weeks ago, pushed very hard to get this, precisely to close the back door to Turkmenistan at the time when all this Ukraine and other struggle was going on that so directly involves Turkmen gas. I would submit that the most important issue right now is getting some kind of east-west Caspian energy corridor. The Russians have been arming the Caspian Sea. We've been helping the Kazakhs and the Azeris to have some kind of response to that. They're also raising Cain about the having polluted the Caspian Sea through this Volga sewer, basically. It's not a very seemly position to be a champion environmentalism simply as a means of stopping any east-west transit. But all of these are efforts to keep the entire region as dependent as possible upon northern routes. Now, what we're proposing with regard to continental trade, however, is not against Russia. On the contrary, and this really has to be emphasized, Russia, especially the Urals, which is not a booming region, let it be said, the Urals has enormously to gain from this. Go to any Ural city, any mayor there will tell you, yeah, this is what we need. You go to West Siberia, the same points. Why? Because it gives them direct access to India, to Pakistan. These are huge economies back and forth. They benefit. This is truly plus-plus strategy.
Can I make a minor point on this? When you look at the Indian access to Central Asia, there's a tendency to focus on North Indian access to Kabul and to Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. And certainly, when I was in Dushanbe, I used to point out to my Indian friends that Dushanbe is closer to Delhi than Madras. That usually got their attention. But if you look at other parts, South India, with the route through Iran, is going to be as close to parts of Central Asia as easy access as it would be otherwise. So the existing situation with the route through Pakistan blocked does hurt North India and Kabul and Dushanbe and Tashkent. But the other route benefits South India, benefits Iran, and of course it benefits the other parts of Central Asia that are a little bit farther away.
Next time we'll pass out a map. Chris?
Chris Schaefer, CNO Resources. Two quick questions, one for Marvin Weinbaum. I'm wondering if you could, you did a very good job of giving the contours of the Pashtun issue, and I appreciate you characterizing the two sort of forces within that. And I'm wondering if you could delve a little bit more into where we stand on the Pashtun issue now. And I'm thinking of things like Karzai's relationship with his own Pashtun community, cleavages within it, which forces in Pakistan are having the greatest voice in the sort of Pashtun community, and what we should be looking there. People I talk to in Afghanistan constantly refer back to this as a major point in terms of the long-term stability of the country and something we often don't give enough attention to. And the other thing, question is for Fred Starr. This might sound a little naive, but why do you need a policy, as it were, to create these sorts of transit and trade? I mean, if there are market opportunities there, it's just going to develop. If we look at something like the cap line, if that's a prop, if we know that the money is to be made, a price will be reached with the between Turkmenistan and their markets. That will bear out. There will be financiers. It will come to play. So what do we? I mean, obviously we need to help build some roads, but what are we talking about in terms of a policy?
Chris, you have to recognize that among the Pashtuns there really is no leadership. And Karzai at the moment is about all that really one would recognize here as a Pashtun leader, in addition to the fact that he has to play a larger role. I see a great deal of this as being an undercurrent here. The real danger in Afghanistan is that we will see a polarization between Pashtun and non-Pashtun. Particularly worried about this with regard to the new parliament, where we saw the beginning of just this kind of development over the election for a speaker. It sort of hangs in the backdrop here. I don't think the Pashtunistan issue is one that should be concern to us at this point. But I think I see the ethnic issue in Afghanistan as always liable to, as I say, come to the surface. But let me say this, that ethnicity in Afghanistan is still negotiable. This is not existential. That the differences among the ethnic groups are ones which require sharing of resources, a certain amount of respect. We're not talking about here oil resources to be divided. We're talking about areas which are negotiable. So my own view is that there are problems within the Pashtun community, and they relate primarily to the fact that that community at this point does not feel that it has been rewarded sufficiently economically with the post-Taliban developments. I think that unless we address this right now, it's that community which is more and more on the fence, and this is the Taliban strategy. It is to keep that area destabilized enough. We're talking about the eastern and southern provinces, to keep it destabilized enough so that it does not feel the progress of reconstruction, and to therefore keep people from making the commitment to the central government, which is necessary if there's going to be a complete political integration.
Take a couple more questions, Chris.
Can I respond?
Oh,
to
yes,
the other
I'm
part?
Sorry.
It's an important point. Obviously, in the long run, one would like to think that market opportunities will prevail. But just as in the Baku-Jehan pipeline, which I think the U.S. very prudently held off on until it was proven to be viable, even though this was is a critical factor in sustaining sovereignties in the region, without the international effort and so on, this would never have happened. Similarly, in the case of land transport, or for that matter, air transport and other things, you need such practical matters, obviously, as infrastructure, which is usually built by the states, except in Virginia, I guess. You need to build infrastructure, the roads. You need also to agree on customs and information. What kind of regimen do you have on the borders? You need to have general security on borders if you're going to have permeability through trade. These involve informations, bilateral, multilateral agreements. They exist everywhere. That's why you're able to get trucks back and forth from Canada to Central America. So my point is that this really won't happen without some serious state involvement. This will release. I mean, I suppose this is DeWitt Clinton and the Erie Canal. This will release a lot of private initiatives and energies. But my suggestion, the U.S. role and the European role, what we were arguing last week, kicking down, I must say, an open door. My suggestion is that we be kind of partners and facilitators in this, be the conveners. The why it doesn't happen often is exactly the reasons that both Marvin and Grant alluded to. It doesn't happen because of old suspicions, lack of personal rapport, whatever it might be. No one will call the meeting. Do we meet in your place or mine? You know. These simple matters, it's easier when a third party calls a meeting. So being a facilitator, being a partner to this, and a well-wisher, is surprisingly can be the core of a real region-wide strategy.
Chris Fair from USIP. I have a question for Marvin. Going back to the two-track strategy that you laid out for Pakistan, and you know, I'm a big fan of putting it that way, but I wonder if you could give some granularity to the FATA issue. So, for example, when I was in Pakistan in August, I had pretty reliable interlocutors tell me that folks in the Frontier Corps were giving away to the bad guys across the border information about our troop locations and our troop movements. So one of the questions that I really wrestle with is this idea of official and unofficial Pakistani support for these activities, and what does that really mean? And I think that the strike of was it the week before last, is perhaps telling. I mean, in the past, we've at least let the Pakistanis have the facade of carrying out the operation, but that wasn't the case here. Absolutely. So I was wondering if you could give some granularity. Who are these actors, and what are the equities that we're confronting in FATA?
Well, we recognize, first of all, that FATA does not view the Taliban and certainly, and Al Qaeda as the enemy. I mean, we start from that premise.
Does everybody know what FATA is?
The federally administrated tribal areas. That is the agencies along the eastern border of Afghanistan. That is the western part of Pakistan. I think what's going on there now, Chris, is that on the official side, Pakistan government has stepped away from the kind of sponsorship that it certainly had earlier on. And what it has done is to subcontract a great deal of the activity which is going on, which enables these elements to thrive to the extent that they are. It has subcontracted this to the jihadi groups, as far as the training is concerned. But the capacity of the Pakistan military right now to carry out the official mission, I think everyone in Pakistan really recognizes, is just not there. It's not there because there has been no successful ability to win over these tribal leaderships. All you can succeed in doing is to buy them off. And it's been pointed out, one of the things that's really been troublesome is that because the military moved in, the civilian connections with the tribal leadership have moved out. And the normal way in which we had to communicate with them and to realize their objectives through the political agents has been superseded by military operations and a military presence, which has by and large been counterproductive. And so right now what you have is you have somewhere between 60 and 80,000 troops, all of whom are bivouacked. And occasionally they'll go out in an operation, but it's at this point it's for show, and you know, because they'll call some journalists in and say, hey, you want to watch us in an operation, and then you know it's theater.
Okay, I'm going to get the last question over here. Did you have a question?
Yeah, we spent an awful lot of time talking about trade issues. The subject also included trafficking and terrorism. It would seem to me that those are the two biggest inhibitors to a kind of strategic trade regime that we're talking about here in Afghanistan, which I think we all believe is the way forward. But at the risk of being castigated for getting down into these tactical issues, how do we deal with terrorism? How do we deal with things like the rule of law, the growing corruption? Well, not the growing corruption, the corruption that is endemic in the Afghan government, the absence of central control over, you know, from the center to the provinces, and the emergence of Afghanistan as a narco-trafficking state whose dimensions have never been seen before.
Good, good.
Well, these are absolutely critical issues. What I would like to suggest is that you don't solve the narcotics matter and then develop trade. You do the other way around. The trade is exactly the engine needed to provide some kind of alternative employment and products for the farming population of Afghanistan. Now, why, it's often been said that given a reasonable alternative, most Afghans will take it. Not all, but most. The reasonable alternative requires not only in national markets, but it requires connection of those to secondary markets. It requires some connection between secondary markets and the remote villages where things are produced. Now, the traffickers have those connections. They have the communications also. This is an easily transported product, easier than some of the alternatives. If you get the mechanism of trade, you have the possibility of normal agricultural produce. So that, I think, is one. Now, with regard to the larger issue of trafficking, the obvious point, and it's worth making again, is that this isn't a matter of some terrible Afghan farmers corrupting the innocent drug users of basically Western Europe. It's the other way around. If it weren't, this is demand driven, and the demand is West Europe and Russia, and increasingly the route along Iran. Now, I've just had a meeting with the incoming EU presidency, and we said to them as bluntly as could be said that This is your moral responsibility. We don't ask that you approve or disapprove of the specific policies the U.S. may pursue or have pursued over 20 years in the Andes and in Colombia and so forth. But we do expect you to take note of the fact that under both Republican and Democratic administrations, there's been a full acknowledgement of moral responsibility. Now, you're used to waving moral flags in our face. This one is yours. There is a $3 billion deficit from the European Union member countries with regard to Afghanistan. And I simply to make this a discussion with regard to your NATO commitments is grossly to understate the nature of it. And we've failed to get this across. The Tajik Drug Agency is a creation largely of the U.S. government. It began when Grant Smith was ambassador there. We are by far the largest contributor to anti-drug efforts in this region. And Britain did some very responsible and worthwhile things in Afghanistan, but by no means fulfilled the obligations that were laid on it. Nor should it have been expected to do so unilaterally. That was a mistake of the Bonn Agreement. The Bonn Agreement sidestepped the fundamental issue, which is European moral responsibility that must be translated into financial commitment to Afghan farmers.
Fred, I would add, though, that the Bonn Agreement indeed was a political document, but it was difficult enough to get that through. Just on David's point, I think we also have to recognize that much of the trade activity in the country now, as David is indicating, is criminalized, and it drives out so much of the rest. And by the way, I must mention this because some of you, I'm sure, read this. But I really see great prospects in the suggestion that's been made about the way to deal with the narcotics issue is to subsidize wheat.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to.
No. This country has written the book on subsidizing wheat. But I explored this with Ali Jalali last week, who is the former minister. And of course, the Afghan approach is, we just need a smarter policy, and we've got to go after the drug traffickers and the labs. And of course, as Dave has suggested, you've got to do that, but you also have to have a judicial system. Right now, they don't even have a place to lock anybody up. I was sitting with the guys who were sending out there in corrections. They've got to build jails to put these people in, not to mention simply adjudicative process. Yeah. But the idea of subsidizing wheat up to the point where it becomes really competitive with growing poppy, I think there's a lot to say for it. There's only one real fly in the ointment. You're going to have to stop the import of wheat from Pakistan. That's going to be the tough thing. But that's doable because whereas heroin goes out on donkeys, wheat's going to come in on trucks. And there you have a much better opportunity to control the border areas. So I'm pushing that idea. It wasn't my idea, certainly, originally. But I think that there's a great deal to be said for this. And then you buy up the surpluses. You have an export crop, not to mention the fact that because this is the great problem. If you take away the income from the farmers, it not only has this 50% impact on GDP, a large part of it goes into the licit economy, the legal economy. And you would be doing enormous damage to the general economy if you didn't have the disposable income, which is created from the criminalized economy. You can take care of that with wheat.
Can I just add a quick note on the question of criminality and terrorism? You're not going to deal with any of these three issues that you raised, the drugs, criminality, corruption, if you will, and terrorism, without having normal local governance. And that's back to the issue. If you cannot have a professional civil service in which someone from Kandahar works in Mazar-e-Sharif and vice versa, it's not going to work. It did, by the way. This is one thing they did have under the king. They had a small, thin, but professional civil service in that respect. But the trouble is, early on, the local police were being paid $16 a month. I mean, this is not really the way to get the loyalty of local police. This is an invitation to corruption, especially when they saw NGOs getting 6-10 times that working in their backyard. Now, how do you pay local civil servants, local police? The government needs an income stream. Right now, every penny of that is coming from the U.S. Unless there's an income stream for the government, there will be no sustainability. This is the centrality of state building, especially at the regional and local level. And how will you have a budget, an income stream for government? By taxes on trade, tariffs on trade, and that is the best hope. Therefore, get on with the trade, and the other things will follow in train.
Well, I want to thank all of our panelists for... assure you that the Institute will continue not only to focus on Afghanistan, we're going to deepen our involvement and hopefully begin to work on the ground there. I do hope that you all join us on February 9th when Barney comes to talk about the Donors Conference.
Thank you.